So kia ora koutou and welcome to our paediatric webinar this evening with Professor Tony Walls, a paediatrician based in Christchurch. I asked him to send me a bio, but he has saved me a job and is going to introduce himself. But from my perspective, we are fellow Cantabrians, if I can say one-eyed. He is quick and clever with words and clearly done a significant amount of research to reach the level of professor. Thank you very much, Tony, for your time and expertise this evening. Tonight, we are spotting the danger, recognising serious illnesses in children with rashes. Our session is supported by the University of Otago Section of Rural Health in the General Practice Department and the Royal New Zealand College of General Practice, notably the Division of Rural Hospital Medicine. Our session is endorsed for 1 hour of CME. So without further ado, I will hand over to Tony and ask him to introduce himself.
Thank you, Lucinda. Nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation to talk. And thank you, everyone, for giving up your evening to be interested, hopefully, in learning a bit about children. I'm aware that we've got a pretty experienced bunch here tonight, and I'm really looking forward to the questions. I'm probably going to learn as much as you guys are. By way of introduction, yeah, Lucinda's pretty much given you the backbone. I'm a paediatrician. I'm an infectious diseases specialist. Used to be the only one in the South Island, but there's a couple more now. And unlike my colleagues at Starship, I work in general paediatrics as well. So I've been wearing two hats. I've actually just been on call for the weekend. So if I start to drift off or talk silly stuff, you'll understand that what that's all about. I'm zooming in from Lincoln, 10-acre block out at Lincoln, but I'm a pretend farmer. I have someone who comes and looks after the place for me. I don't do any of that stuff. But I do consider myself not a townie. I went to school in South Otago and then at Darfield High School, not one of those townie schools, which they always talked about in Christchurch. This evening, really, after talking to Lucinda, I wanted to go over some of the sort of serious presentations that present with a rash. So this is not really a dermatology presentation, and I'm not a dermatologist, but I wanted to go through some of the sort of things that are probably a bit rarer, but serious, and things that you don't really want to miss, especially if you're a little bit isolated. And many of the things we talk about today is it's focused on the sort of clinical signs you might see where really important to have thought about the serious diagnosis and know a little bit about what to do in the first instance as well. So I'm hoping there's a bit there for everyone. We're not going to cover absolutely everything, obviously, but there's a bit of variety there. So almost all the images you'll see tonight are available on DermNet if you want to have a look at them. So I'm going to start with common. I'm going to start with chickenpox, which I guess is a bit less common than it used to be. And I'm working on the theory that everyone knows what chickenpox looks like if you haven't had it yourself. We've had a vaccine against chickenpox. I can't even remember how many years it's been going now, but for a number of years. So in the future, we're going to get less and less chickenpox seen than when we were growing up. And it's not a diagnosis that involves lab tests, is it? As you see it, you know what it looks like, that, hey, that's chickenpox. But I guess it gets a bit more complicated when there's been vaccinations because we see it less often. And sometimes you get modified disease in someone who's been vaccinated. So it gets a bit complicated. But in general terms, I just wanted to go over the bits that I worry about with chickenpox and just touch on a few sort of ideas about the questions, I guess, that have come up for me over the years as well. So the main thing I worry about is superficial or secondary skin and soft tissue infections that happen. And obviously those are going to happen a little bit down the track when someone's been scratching away at their lesions and then got infected. And we did an audit or survey of all the serious complications building up to introducing the vaccine. And actually this was by far the most common thing. So kids being in hospital with a nasty infection following their chickenpox was the thing that was most common. Not the most severe, but the most common. So skin abscesses and other stuff that's a bit more significant sometimes. The other thing I worry about is in pregnant women, and we'll cover that a little bit later on, but I'm certainly concerned if there's chickenpox floating around and the woman's pregnant. And I guess the one that gets the most publicity, or the one that I guess I'm guessing most people worry about the most, is the immune compromised people who are exposed to chickenpox. And I'm going to be talking about children, obviously, and so most of that is the cancer kids, pretty much. I mean, there's a few other kids who are on immunosuppressants that we worry about, like those with IBD and other chronic diseases, but it's by and large, I'll be talking about the cancer kids. So a couple of things about our vaccine. So we give a single dose of vaccine at 15 months, and if you read the packet insert, it says you should have two. But one dose is pretty much 100% effective at stopping you ending up with severe disease, so ending up in hospital. But if you've been vaccinated and you're exposed to chickenpox, about 15% of kids will get a rash. They'll get some sort of illness. It's usually mild. It's usually less than 20 to 50 spots or something, but they will get chickenpox. So a single dose doesn't eliminate chickenpox from circulating in our community. So we should continue to see chickenpox. I guess we need to be thinking about modified chickenpox. So the question is, have your child been vaccinated? Really important in terms of will they get severe disease, but it doesn't stop them getting chickenpox. And very occasionally, someone will get severe disease if they've had varicella vaccine. So actually, places like the US give two doses. And if you have two doses, that gets rid of that sort of 15% who still get spots. So it's more effective. But we, Pharmac, have got to decide on the basis of how much it costs and stuff. So we have gone with one. Maybe one day the fantasy world in the future will have two doses of chickenpox vaccine for kids. Just remember, though, if the child has not been vaccinated, they are eligible for a funded vaccine. If they haven't had chickenpox and never been vaccinated, at age 11, there's a freebie for them. So just think about that if you are involved with adolescent immunizations at any stage, because I think it's one of those things that probably gets forgotten. And I hand on heart, as a lad who had chickenpox at the age of 14 and had it pretty nasty and was off school for 3 weeks, I would strongly recommend vaccination as an adolescent if you haven't had it, because as we all know, the older you get when you get primary varicella, the sometimes the worse it is. Yeah, just keep that in mind. And remember that this is a live attenuated vaccine, the one that we currently use. And again, careful who you might be giving to if you're thinking about people with immune deficiencies. You can vaccinate someone in the household of someone with an immune deficiency. That's not a problem because they're unlikely to pass it on. In fact, we'd prefer them going through that tiny risk of passing something on than getting chickenpox and exposing the person they live with. So that's a little bit about the vaccine. And infection control is what I really want to talk about, because I think this is the thing that probably causes the most phone calls to the ID specialist. Incredibly transmissible varicella. It's a respiratory droplet spread, or aerosol, I should say, spreads down the corridor of hospitals, basically, if someone's in hospital. So we really reluctant to admit any child with varicella to hospital if we can avoid it. And if we do, they need to be in isolation with the door closed and a negative pressure room, just because if we've got a whole bunch of children who are either too young to be vaccinated or are immunocompromised, the risk of passing varicella around is fine. In an adult ward, it doesn't matter because we assume everyone's had chickenpox at some stage or been vaccinated. But on a kid's ward, we try and avoid it. So if you rang up and say, I've got this kid who's really sick with chickenpox, if someone's a bit resistant, that might be why. And they're infectious from about 2 days before they've got the rash. So when you see someone with a rash, you've got to think back a little bit to who might have been exposed until all the lesions are crusted over. So once they're all crusted, they can still look pretty poxy, but they are no longer infectious once they've all crusted over. So that's just important when you're thinking about who might be exposed. So the next thing I want to go over was just a couple of, I've called it varicella quiz, but it's not really, is it? But what to do with exposures. And I guess the first comment about exposure is there's a lot of, oh, this could have been chickenpox exposures. And the first question I'm always asking as an ID specialist, was it really chickenpox? And sometimes that requires some testing if that's possible, but you really want more than just, oh, someone thought it was chickenpox, because some of the actions you take are actually a bit of a big deal depending on who the child is. So let's just first start, a healthy unvaccinated child exposed to chickenpox, what are you going to do? And essentially, you do nothing. You let them get chickenpox if they're otherwise healthy. Even if they're an older kid, do nothing and let them get chickenpox with the answer. Now, you can do something because in the oncology kids, we do try and prevent them getting clinical chickenpox by giving them acyclovir, and I'll come to this later. So you can do stuff, but in general terms, we would try and not make a big deal of it and say your child's going to get chickenpox and this is what it's going to look like. 3 to 5 days of rash and manage it at home with symptomatic measures. Yeah, healthy unvaccinated children, we just let it go and then suggest that, hey, vaccination could have been a pretty good idea and maybe have that vaccination talk if they haven't been vaccinated otherwise. So next one I want to talk about was infants, little babies who might have been exposed to chickenpox. And again, this is one of those situations where really important that you confirm that it was chickenpox or that there's a strong suspicion that it was chickenpox. Because infants less than 28 days of age are really the ones in terms of the pediatric population that I get pretty worried about. Older than that, a 2-year-old getting chickenpox, not going to be much fun for anyone at home, but it's not the end of the world. But a little baby, potentially that could be bad. But it's all dependent on whether mum's had chickenpox or not, whether this baby has got protective antibodies by passive immunity. So they're a high risk of severe disease at this age. But if mum's had chickenpox, then we just watch them carefully and they actually don't do anything. They're going to be fine. And that brings up the question was, how do we know mum's had chickenpox? And there's plenty of research that shows that actually a history from a family member of whether that child had chickenpox or not is as good as a blood test sometimes. Pretty much the same. So there's no need to confirm by blood test. If I guess Nana or Granddad see that mum has had chickenpox, we go with that. Because actually chickenpox used to be so common that everyone knew what it looks like. And so it's fine. So you don't actually need serological confirmation in general. So in an infant like this, they're little, we're going to be worried about them. We're going to keep a close eye. If they get some spots, we want to see them early. But happy if mum's had chickenpox to watch and wait. It's a bit different if mum's never had chickenpox, then we might be a bit cautious. And I think this is where you really probably want to talk to someone, get on the phone to someone about what to do. And we might consider some sort of preemptive therapy with acyclovir if it was a really close contact, it was really confirmed, we knew for certain mum hadn't. And in fact, one of the processes in this situation might be to do an antibody test on mum. Because sometimes people have had asymptomatic chickenpox and never known they've had it, or the history is not quite right, or something. So that might be one of the steps they do. So if you've got a little infant who's been exposed and you think it's a genuine exposure, the first question is, do we think mum has had chickenpox? And if it's a term infant, they will have this antibody protection, which will go for several months and they're fine. So we can just watch and wait. So I hope that kind of makes sense.
Yep,
Next
good.
question, cancer kids. These are ones we are worried about. And again, comes back to what my first question is always, what was the actual exposure? And if it really was chickenpox, then we don't mess around, basically. Even if the child has had chickenpox before, now that they've had chemotherapy, we kind of work on the assumption that all their immunity is wiped out. We revaccinate them after their chemotherapy. They may still have some antibodies, they may still have protection, but because of the risk, we actually just assume they don't have any protection. And those kids, because they're at high risk of severe chickenpox and complications, we would give zoster immunoglobulin so that they have that passive immunity. And then also our guys, I think this might be on the Starship protocol, actually around the time of peak viremia, which is about 7 to 10 days after exposure, they start them on acyclovir because there is some data that suggested if you could dampen down that peak viremia, the severity of the chickenpox is less. So it's a double whammy, some immunoglobulin and some post-exposure acyclovir. Now, it does become complicated when there's chickenpox circulating in the community because there can be lots of potential exposures, and then I don't know. And this is, I think, something the oncologists deal with all the time. And so, if in doubt, give someone a call would be my thing about what their previous exposures were. But you might get asked to give them some zoster immunoglobulin if there's been a clear exposure. Again, the information they're going to want is, did you really know that this was chickenpox they were exposed to and how close they're exposed to? And it's not walking past someone in the street, but being in the same household is definitely a strong contact. Being at a party, a children's party where they're in touch for 2 or 3 hours would be a significant contact. What I've got next. Oh, cancer. Oh, exposure to shingles. That gets people confused sometimes. So, shingles, obviously, the person has got a superficial rash. And shingles, there are case reports of people passing on varicella from shingles, but it's usually really quite close contact. So, someone directly in the family. So, most people who have shingles who have it covered up, if it's on their body, the risk of them spreading it around the room is really low, and we don't usually do anything. But if you had a heavily immunocompromised child who was exposed in the house to someone with shingles, it's certainly worth discussing with an oncologist about what we'd want to do under those circumstances. And I think there's probably differences of opinion, but if they were really, let's say, post bone marrow transplant or something, really heavily immunosuppressed, I think some people would probably err on the side of caution and give them some just like treatment for the oncology kids. So it's not the same as chickenpox. There have been some reported cases of transmission, but it's really rare actually. So this one I would pass over. Someone might give me a call about this one, and we just you need to do it by case basis.
Okay.
Pregnant woman. Now, obviously, chickenpox for pregnant woman is potentially a drama if it's their first exposure, and a primary infection can be quite nasty in pregnancy. But I guess I'm going to show my bias as a pediatrician and say that I'm worried about the fetus and the baby. Really big deal if mum gets primary infection early in pregnancy. So in the first 12 weeks, there is like the risk of varicella affecting the fetus is low, but dreadful if it occurs potentially. And so we would get really worried about a pregnant woman who was exposed specifically early in pregnancy. Later in pregnancy, it's less of a problem, but it would be a drama. But again, it comes back to this question. If mum's exposed to chickenpox when she's pregnant, the first question is, have you had chickenpox yourself? And if she has, we can back off and not worry about it. So again, you can see we're quite reliant on a history of chickenpox when there's been an exposure. But we actually trust a good history that mum will have had it. Most people get on the phone to their own mother or father and usually get a reliable history, unless there's about 12 of them, in which case they can't remember, but they've probably all had it anyway at the same time. The big deal, though, is if mum has never had chickenpox and then she gets chickenpox just around the time of birth. So 5 days before to 2 days after. If mum gets spots during that time, that's a big deal, and I would treat the baby immediately. And the reason I would treat the baby immediately is they haven't had long enough to get passive immunity from mum. They will have been connected to a placenta when mum's peak viremia. And so there's a double whammy of severe risk for that infant. So the numbers are important. But I guess what the take-home message would be, anytime you come across a woman who develops varicella around the time of birth, that's dangerous. Dangerous for the baby. So you need to think about carefully, and probably they need to be someone on some IVACyclovir. Okay, so we hope that's incredibly rare. But if you come across it, that is a real worry.
There's just one question from the chat. If a child has had a missed varicella vaccine at 15 months, can they get it later on at age 4 or 5 as a catch-up?
They can get any time. I don't think it's funded at that age. I would have to check. I think it's only and equally at 11. If you're not 11, if you're 13, I don't think it's funded. So it's a funding issue rather. They can have it, obviously, but it's a funding issue. It's a good question.
Thanks.
Cool. Okay, I'll bash on. So this is a real life case. 15-month-old child, 3 days of fever, coryza cough, sticky eyes, rash for 36 hours, spreading rapidly in the body. And she'd had MMR 5 days beforehand. This was in 2019, and there was measles in the community. And this girl had measles. Despite the best intentions of their parents, and this was at the time when MMR was just given at 15 months, it wasn't given at 12 months. And the poor little girl had measles. And she looks miserable, doesn't she? Now, measles is, I think the etymology around the word comes from misery. And it's absolutely right. Now, I'm an ID specialist. I'm privileged to have lived in a world where we've had measles vaccine. And this is one of the few cases of measles I've seen. Many of you will have seen many more cases, but you will understand we're pretty worried at the moment about measles being imported into New Zealand because of our low vaccination rates. So it's going to come around in no time at all, I'm sure. And just to explain, so this child would have, if they got rash, is day zero with the rash coming out. That was 5 days after they were vaccinated. So they were vaccinated in here, but had clearly been exposed long before they were vaccinated. Now, sometimes you can prevent measles by vaccinating them at the time of the exposure. So that's a thing to think about. But this child was exposed back here, had their incubation period, then got vaccinated. It wasn't early enough to cause a problem. She went on to have clinical measles. And so I just wanted to go through case definition for measles because so that everyone's aware and can spot it. I'm sure many of you have done this anyway, so I'll go through it fairly quickly. But it's fever. The rash, just like that girl had, which starting mainly behind the ears and neck and then spreading absolutely everywhere. and need one of these following things: cough, coryza, conjunctivitis, or spots. And blood tests in an epidemic or an outbreak are not required. You just have, it's a clinical diagnosis. So everyone should be familiar with what measles looks like. But if you're the first to see someone in your community with measles, you do need to be testing, because public health will need confirmation. And so you'd notify and we'd get testing done. And, oh, sorry, Koplik spots. That's often something that comes up. Those are the little white dots you can see there. Again, I haven't seen them before. DermNet's wonderful, isn't it? And it's just because I haven't seen lots of cases of measles. In the 1960s, people just know what these look like. We're lucky we don't have that anymore. So laboratory confirmation, it's by PCR these days. So you need to do a throat swab and send it to the lab, and they will get that done pretty quickly. It's all done in Christchurch in terms of the National Measles Lab. And measles IgM, this is from the Starship guidelines. They suggest a measles IgM, but in fact, most people are just using a PCR. And it's a throat swab or a nasopharyngeal swab. I'd suggest a throat swab is the easiest thing to do in most littlies and get it off straight away. And of course, we don't have treatment for measles. So it's all about, from my point of view, trying to recognize and prevent community outbreaks of measles. And just as a reminder, if we didn't have measles vaccination, this is a publication that sort of estimated how bad it would be. Pretty much every child gets it. So over 10 years, that's about 600,000 cases. We think about 1 in 10 kids, or a little bit more in recent outbreaks, ended up in hospital with measles. 1 in 1,000 get encephalitis. 1 in 1,000 die. It's not a benign case disease, which many people sometimes think it is. And if anyone is arguing with you about how benign or otherwise it is, just remind them that there was something like 135 deaths in Samoa when measles went through there in 2019. So that's why we're pretty worried about measles as an outbreak, and entirely preventable. If we had good immunization coverage, I wouldn't have been putting measles slides up. We don't. It's going to come from somewhere around the world at some stage, and we're going to have measles outbreaks. So it may be that you guys are having to spot it.
What is SSPE?
That is the long-term complication of, and that's a really panencephalitis. Sclerosing panencephalitis, which happens very rarely, happens 15 to 20 years after you've had measles. You have a rapid deterioration in your brain and brain rot, basically. It's not good. I've never seen a case either. But it's all right, so let's move on. So a couple of other diseases I want to talk about, and hopefully people know a little bit of these. So this is staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome. This is a little infant who, you can see, has got peeling skin all over themselves. These babies are pretty miserable, as you can imagine. People are always going to seek help when the baby's skin starts peeling off like this. It's mostly a young child's disease. So little babies, but also up to about 3 or 4 would probably be the oldest they get, the scalded skin syndrome. But very occasionally you might see an older child. And this might be a typical case, a 2-year-old with a high fever, really grumpy and irritable, and then this kind of peely, sunburny type rash. It does look like a burn, and I've put the question down, how would you manage it? And essentially, you manage it a bit like a sunburn, but with antibiotics, or another burn, but with antibiotics. So they get some cefazolin or flucloxacillin IV, plenty of pain relief, plenty of fluids. And this is one that I'm thinking probably you might want to send to a bigger center if you saw a little baby with this, because they are quite difficult to manage in terms of the analgesia and fluid shifts, all that sort of stuff. The good thing is that it's not like some other toxin-mediated diseases where you lose your blood pressure and can die with it, but it is pretty uncomfortable for the babies, and often they're on a morphine infusion and needing a lot of help with that. So that's staphylococcal. And the thing is, it doesn't have to be a big superficial skin infection. It can be a tiny cut. Because it's a toxin-mediated disease, any tiny cut or pimple or anything can potentially, if you've got the right staphy bug, cause this staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome.
Does the skin typically end up desquamating the whole body, or can it be quite focused?
Yeah, so I tell mums and dads they're going to peel. Yep.
Okay.
And it's an exfoliative toxin, one of these toxins, so it's dependent on which type of bug it is. This baby, this might have come from their umbilicus and then turned into this with toxin-mediated loss of the epidermis. They don't have their mouth involved, so hopefully they can still feed, and that makes it different from Stevens Johnson or some of the other toxin-mediated diseases. But it's usually the age group. So if you get widespread peely burn-like skin in a little baby or a toddler, then often that's the staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome. And I guess its bark is worse than its bite. It looks really awful, but it's in terms of the infection, it's only a small amount of bugs, but it's a nasty toxin. And the toxin is different from some of the other systemic toxin in that it's really attacking the skin. And any baby that's got a peeling skin like this is at risk of superficial infection in addition, but generally we would put them on antibiotics. It usually ends up with a drip because they need pain relief, they need fluids, and occasionally they need a little bit more than that, but mostly it's just a nasty complication of a superficial skin infection.
Thank you.
Cool. Next case history. Going to move on to that's all right. So this is a child, 4-year-old child, 7-day history of unexplained fever, high temperatures, really irritable, swollen lips and tongue, lymphadenopathy, conjunctivitis. And if you see this child, really red cheeks, puffy lips that look bright red, perhaps cracks appearing around them, and that might even be a strawberry tongue in there as well. So this child has Kawasaki disease, and Kawasaki disease is one of the things that really important to spot. Really important to spot because these children need a referral to somewhere where they can have an echo with someone who's good at doing pediatric echoes. So this is Tomisaku Kawasaki, the man who first described it back in the 1960s. And I think he was actually like a registrar or something that obviously had noticed there was like 50 kids he'd noticed with a similar sort of presentation. And the key thing is they've got to have a fever for 5 days. Then they have these kind of toxin-mediated signs, which I'll show you some pictures of in a minute. And we don't have another explanation for it. And again, thanks to DermNet for all of these things, or actually, this is the Kawasaki Foundation, but they typically have a conjunctivitis that's red but not pussy. Those lips that I talked about there, strawberry tongue, they can have big lymph nodes. Later on, the peeling skin doesn't happen acutely. Happens weeks later sometimes, but you look for swelling or a little bit of peeling around the periungual region around their toes, puffy, swollen feet. And actually, for me, this is the big thing. They're as miserable as all hell. They are just horrible looking kids and have been for 3 or 4 days. Usually, mums and dads have been battling away at home. Temperatures don't go down with Panadol. They're really irritable. And in fact, if you do a lumbar puncture on them, many of them have an aseptic meningitis and an inflammation. It's probably that's what's making them so grumpy. So I just wanted, this is, yep. Sorry,
Does
Lucinda.
the fever, or you might be about to say, does the fever predate these, or do
Yes.
they coexist
Yeah,
or
there's
compare?
no hard and fast rule, but quite often fever's always the key thing. You've got to have had high fevers for 5 days. And often that's the thing that brings them to their doctor first. Hey, they've had a fever for 3 days and we've been using Brufen and Panadol, we can't get rid of it. And they're really miserable. And then you go looking and you find these other things. That's often the way it is, rather than they present with a rash, but the rash is a common feature. So the rash, measles, but it can be lots of different things. So I've seen it all. Basically, they can have a maculopapular rash, they can have like target lesions, they can have peeling skin, lots of different things. And in that context of 5 days of fever, if you've got a rash and they're a little one, start to think about Kawasaki disease. We talked about the strawberry tongue and the red lips and the cracked lips, which is really a key feature. Those eyes, red eyes. So there aren't many things that give you those two things together. Red eyes, the whites of their eyes, but without being sticky and like a not like a viral conjunctivitis. And then these sort of puffy hands and feet and periungual desquamation sometimes. So I'm always looking at kids' fingernails and toenails when I'm worrying about Kawasaki disease. And then finally, they can get big lymph nodes, and they've got to be bigger than a centimeter to fulfill the criteria. So there's no test for it. It's a list of criteria, but actually, I would suggest if you guys in a rural setting are seeing someone who's had 5 days of fever and has any of these, err on the side of caution, get talking to someone, probably post them somewhere where they can do an echo, because that's what we're worried about. And that's my next question. Why are we worried about Kawasaki disease? The reason we're worried about Kawasaki disease is that 25% of them untreated will end up with coronary artery aneurysms. So it is a big deal. The rest of it will recover, but we need to be treating them early to prevent coronary artery aneurysms, which can obviously have long-term complications for these children. So I guess the take-home message is 5 days of fever in any little E that you can't find a good explanation for. They don't have a UTI, they've not got a snot nose and a cough, there's nothing on their x-ray. You can't figure it out why they're hot and it's been going for 5 days. I'd be posting them on to someone with that question, Kawasaki disease. And it should always get them through the door. I think this child's got Kawasaki disease. I would have thought it would always get through the door. All right. So there's a couple of other things though that might give you the red eyes or the strawberry tongue, which I think of characteristic signs of toxin-mediated disease. We think Kawasaki is a toxin-mediated vasculitis, but we don't actually know what the toxin is. And here's my list. Kawasaki is at the top. I'm just going to briefly mention the post-COVID like Kawasaki disease thing, scarlet fever, and then toxic shock. So here's the multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children that happens post-COVID. And you might have heard a little bit about Kawasaki-like disease post-COVID. This is really weird. This is a new thing we learned about COVID. Actually, New Zealand didn't have much of this, and I haven't seen any for a long time. I apologize, you're not going to see anything. I just find it really fascinating. It's Kawasaki disease, except it's older kids. The English, of course, wanted a different name. PIMS TS, which is a bit posh, isn't it? Pediatric Inflammatory Multisystem Syndrome, temporarily associated with SARS-CoV-2. I think I'll go with Miss C, actually. But it's Kawasaki disease, only older. So a lot of these kids looked exactly like the Kawasaki disease. But whereas with Kawasaki, the average age is somewhere between 2 and 3, maybe a little younger, the average age for these COVID kids was about 8 or 9. So it was really odd. These 8 or 9 year olds, or sometimes a bit older, looking like they got Kawasaki disease. And it was happening 3 or 4 weeks or even longer after they'd had COVID. And that was the average age. And we only actually had about 10 or 11 cases in New Zealand. And the reason for that was there was a whole bunch of them with the early COVID strains. But by the time Omicron came to New Zealand, we think that Omicron was much less likely to do it. And now that we've got kids that had COVID, or some might have been vaccinated, this is almost never going to happen. But it's just a really interesting, forgive me, I've been ranting about something that I think really interesting. So if you hear about post-COVID syndrome in kids, this is the thing that is the top of the list. In the UK, I was over there on sabbatical just recently. They have clinics for kids following up this because they had Kawasaki-like complications. Anyway, I digress. Scarlet fever. So scarlet fever, if you're any history buffs amongst you, because in Edwardian times or Victorian times, scarlet fever, big deal. Group A streptococcal infection. We don't have antibiotics. These kids got really sick. But we've never got a cure for scarlet fever. It still happens, and there are some characteristic features of scarlet fever. The good thing is that in an antibiotic era, you can just give them some penicillin and they should be right. These kids don't often get real sick, but recognizing scarlet fever still important. Actually, going back to the COVID thing, there's been a big surge around the world of group A streptococcal disease post-COVID in children. And so actually, this now is the time when we should be having a lookout for scarlet fever. And I'm sure you've seen plenty of cases over the years. So to get scarlet fever, you need group A streptococcal infection with a strain that produces this toxin. And you also need to have no antitoxin antibodies. So I've never been exposed to that kind of strain and the toxin in the past. So it's usually young children, because older children and adults have usually somewhere along the line encountered this bug. And so have these antibodies that are protective, but the littlies don't. So it's usually somewhere about that age. And scarlet fever looks nasty and it has many of the features of a toxin-mediated disease, but actually it's very treatable and they usually don't end up shocked and horrible. And so these will be some characteristic features, again, thanks to DermNet. So the things I think about are, again, the puffy lips and cracked lips that you get in Kawasaki disease, circumoral pallor, so red lips, but pale around there, Now, obviously, that's a little bit easier on whitey skin rather than dark skin, but that's a characteristic feature. Then they get this kind of raised, bumpy, sandpaper-like rash that is absolutely everywhere all over their body. Can get mixed up with measles, but if you take a history of a sore throat or school sores or some other group A streptococcal infection, it's usually pretty obvious where it might have come from. And the rash is sandpapery. So it's little bumps everywhere and it's everywhere. So often it's actually recognizing the rash is the thing that tips you off that this could be scarlet fever. They are unwell, they've got a high fever sometimes, but and you might have had a history of a sore throat, but they've got this rash that's come on and it feels like sandpaper. And their skin can come off. If you give it a good rub, their skin will peel. As things go on, just like Kawasaki disease, they might get a full dermatological peel, not that these children need it, and they'll get it for free. All right. So that's really important because you need to let mums and dads know that this skin is all going to peel off potentially so that they don't freak out when a week later everything starts peeling. So as long as they know it's coming, it's a bit easier. So yeah, they get treated just like a strep throat with 10 days of penicillin. And the rash may last 5 or 6 days, but hopefully they're feeling much better before the rash goes away.
Just, I've got a couple of questions.
Yeah,
So
sure.
in terms of the time frame between the group A strep infection and the development of scarlet fever, is it like a wee bit like
It's
rheumatic
you.
fever and
No,
a
it's
week later?
different.
Or...
It's usually about the time they've got a sore throat. So it's a bit easier
Okay.
in terms of your history taking. You might even be able to swab their throat and identify the group A strep at the time. And obviously, the vast majority of kids who get strep throat don't end up with scarlet fever. It's luck of the draw whether you get toxin-producing group A strep strain, whether you're going to end up with a scarlet fever or not. But it can be superficial skin infections as well. It doesn't have to be a sore throat. Anything that's got a group A strep infection can do it. But yeah, that's a really good question, isn't it? It is about as it is at the time. So you should be able to
Okay.
isolate that.
And there's obviously numerous regimes of penicillin out there.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued. Well, I've got a pediatrician here, particularly in ID. With
I
one
think.
regime, do particularly in, I mean, I work in Tairāwhiti, so we have a lot of this sort of issue. Is the once daily amoxicillin effective, or should we
So,
be considering like penicillin old school?
yeah, I guess in the absence of data, I'd be leaning to old school in scarlet fever. Obviously, in rheumatic fever, there's been some really good studies in New Zealand showing that to clear your group A strep infection once daily or twice daily amoxil is actually really good. And I'm all for fewer doses. I
Okay.
think usually these are kids who are pitching up to hospital pretty unwell with high fevers. And I'd probably be going old school actually. But again, that's just because I'm not sure anyone's really done the trials to look at more simplified regimes. And
And should we be referring these children from our rural hospitals into?
no, I don't think so. If you are confident in the diagnosis of scarlet fever and they don't have cardiovascular instability, and I think you can probably watch them. So if they've got typical features of the skin rash and they've got a history of a sore throat, I think I'd be comfortable most often getting them on antibiotics early. You might put a drip in them, give them some IV antibiotics early, and you could watch. Assuming that they don't have the things we're going to talk about next, which is toxic shock type features, where the diagnosis will be different. So, yeah, I think in general, scarlet fever can be managed close to home.
And just to go back to Kawasaki disease, what is the management of Kawasaki disease?
Yeah, absolutely. Apologies, I should have mentioned it. So, management of Kawasaki disease is first IVIG infusion. Intravenous immunoglobulin with a big dose. We would give that, and obviously that's something that needs to be done in hospital. It's like an 8-hour infusion, that sort of stuff. And the key thing is they all need an echocardiogram at some stage. So if they're coming from a rural location, you're not going to be able to get a pediatric echo done. And so that's another reason for getting them to a larger center where they can get an echo done because that's really important to know about long-term complications, which is why we're treating them. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Cool. We'll move on. So the next one I want to talk about I haven't made this one up because it was a real case when I was a registrar working in Timaru Hospital. And it was a long time ago, so I might not remember the exact details. But anyway, this girl was 13, sudden onset of widespread rash that looked a bit like a scarlet fever rash. She'd had fever, diarrhea, and was pretty crook. Really high temperature, tachycardia for a big girl, and her blood pressure was a little bit flaky. Slow capillary refill time, and she had this widespread rash. And interestingly, I got a phone call once I'd gone home. I thought, oh my God, she's got meningococcal disease or something. And I gave her fluids, antibiotics, loaded with everything. And she came right and she was absolutely fine. I got this phone call on Monday morning from the pediatrician, who was dreadfully polite, and went, you don't think she could have had toxic shock syndrome, do you? And of course, the most important question is, has she got a period? Because tampon-associated staphylococcal toxic shock remains the commonest cause of toxic shock disease. In the 1980s, I'm told tampons were super absorbent and there was a real problem. And there was something like, I think I've got it on the next slide, there was something like 800 cases across the US in 1 year. There was like an epidemic of toxic shock syndrome. And most of them occurred in women and most of them were menstruating at the time. And so this girl had a period. We were able to take a tampon and culture it, and she had staphylococcus there, and they were able to isolate a toxin-producing staph aureus. Any staph aureus infection can do this, but even nowadays, this is the most common presentation of a rare presentation is related to menstruation. Toxic shock is caused by an abnormal immune response, by superantigens produced by the bacteria. And superantigens are really interesting pathophysiologically. And there are several different toxins that can be produced by a staph aureus. You don't really need to know their names. Toxic shock is the sort of real serious end that I worry about. Interestingly, I was on the weekend. I've got a kid who presented with this. He was a boy who had ridden a motorbike for the first time, wasn't very good. It fell on him. He got a burn on his leg. It was managed at home pretty good for a little while, got infected, suddenly comes into hospital with a spreading rash, abnormal liver function tests, really high fever. He didn't get hypotensive, but he looked like he might go there, and he became really unwell really quickly. He's doing fine, and he got all right with some antibiotics and some fluids, but it's a really serious condition. So it can be either staph aureus or Streptococcus pyogenes. They produce this endotoxin, and essentially they produce a cytokine storm by stimulating your T cells en masse. So normally if you have something that stimulates your T cells, it's like 1 in 1,000% of your T cells are activated. And that's because it's done via antigen-presenting cells. But toxin-mediated disease bypasses that situation and you end up with 20% of your T cells activated. So this is a rapid deterioration with many of the clinical signs that you look like with Kawasaki disease and we're talking about. So red eyes, red lips, rash all over them. But in addition to that, they start losing their blood pressure and have shock. And then they develop other organ systems involved. And my boy on the weekend had coagulopathy and abnormal liver function tests. Other children might have respiratory complications. So toxic shock is a really nasty thing. And it can happen again with any sort of staphylococcal or streptococcal infection. If you've got the wrong sort of bug causing it, that's toxin producing, this can happen and happen really fast. So these are kids that you need to be on the lookout for, and they need a helicopter if you're in a remote region as quick as they can, because some of them can end up in ICU pretty damn quickly. Yep.
Is there a specific time frame? Can you have your infection, say you have your burn or whatever, and does it happen pretty rapidly, like 1 or 2 days after, or can it be 1 to 2 weeks? And the same with I'm interested in the period, girls with the tampons. Historically, I haven't seen a case of that for a long fever, but it was the girls who held the tampons in for too long. Just that factor, or is it typically like day 3 or 4 or 5 of their period? Is it
I think certainly everyone changed the recommendations after that in terms of how long you should have a tampon in place. I think they changed the absorbency of tampons at that time. There was something to do with the magnesium content of them as well that promoted bugs growing. So there was a whole lot of changes. In terms of your first question, if someone, this can develop rapidly, kind of, but someone's got to have an established infection. So my boy who'd had the motorbike accident and had a burn, that became infected. And then as it became more infected, suddenly it became cellular looking, then it became systemic, and then the rash. So it is a progressive type thing. And the earlier you recognize it, the better, obviously, for the children. But those things like the red eyes and the cracked lips and this rash that just is rapidly spreading over their whole body that might make you think of scarlet fever or might make you think of Kawasaki disease. If the context is a staph infection or a strep infection, then those are the ones that really need identification early because they can become really critically unwell really quickly. So they need careful attention. And if they become shocked, they basically need fluid resuscitation really urgently. So here's the sort of definitions just to go through. So they've got to have fever. To be toxic shock, they've really got to have, excuse me, low blood pressure. And my boy on the weekend didn't actually drop his blood pressure, so he didn't quite meet the criteria. Widespread red rash, and this rash goes on to peel as well, just like those other things, toxin mediated, they end up with peely skin afterwards. And then this is the thing that it's systemic. There's multiple organ systems involved. My girl from Timaru all those years ago had florid diarrhea. And my boy on the weekend, I'm pretty sure he had diarrhea as well. Severe muscle aches, so they can get a myositis as well. So getting a CK might be helpful. My boy had hepatic injury. They can get an acute kidney injury. They can drop some of their platelet lines or be lymphopenic or all sorts of things that can happen. And sometimes they get central nervous system involvement, although I'm not seeing that very often. But here's the thing. A lot of those things that we're talking about with Kawasaki disease or scarlet fever pitching up here, red eyes, swollen lips, things that I think of as toxin-mediated disease. So I guess I'm trying to convince people to be on the lookout for those sorts of things. And again, it doesn't need to be a major infection to start with. A superficial cut that's become infected could do this. Obviously, having a tampon in is not some major infection, is it? It's just something that has developed because of it's a case where bugs can be incubating. So, yeah, those are the sort of things we'll be looking out for. So, streptococcal toxic shock, similar presentation to staphylococcal, similar pathogenesis in that it's a superantigen, but it's often associated with other things like tonsillitis or other group A strep infections like school sores or those sort of things. So, I in my head lump all these things together. And I tend to think of it as is this toxin mediated? So I'm always on the lookout for those rapidly spreading rashes. I'm looking in kids' eyes. I'm asking mum and dad, are their lips a bit more swollen than they would be normally? Tongue out, having a look at those sort of things. And it's really about spotting them early if you're going to do well. And toxic shock, just in terms of management, just very briefly, it's all about resuscitation fluids and also about antibiotics, excuse me, broad spectrum antibiotics. I would get on the phone to someone pretty early. They're almost certainly going to recommend you treat them with broad spectrum antibiotics as well as clindamycin or linezolid, which are two antibiotics that we think have antitoxin effects. Clindamycin is obviously going to work for group A strep and staphylococcal bugs as well, and it has the advantage of also covering MRSA. But mostly we would give it in combination to try and reduce the amount of toxin-mediated disease. But it's really about acute resuscitation. I'll take that back. It's about recognizing it. And if you've got saggy blood pressure, acute resuscitation diet and just pouring fluids into them and giving them antibiotics. But yeah, this is helicopter trip stuff as well, I think. Cool. So I've talked about a bunch of things about related to various presentations, and I've just put these up again because there's the cracked lips, it's the strawberry tongue, it's the widespread rash that we're worried about. Final topic, meningococcal disease, which is anyone who's grown up in New Zealand in the 90s and 2000s knows all about it. Horrible disease, always got dreadful pictures. I'm sure many of you have dealt with this before and seen it acutely. I'm going to pass over things. There are different sort of serogroups, lots of them, but these are the only ones that cause disease. But it's different at different parts of the world. And this is a really old slide, but it just shows that in different parts of the world, in North America, Group B, much less prominent than in Australia or New Zealand or in Europe, in Africa, had a completely different sort. This is our epidemic in New Zealand that we'll all, fondly is not the word, is it? Remember, where there was lots of meningococcal disease. Māori and Pacific kids, by far the worst affected. Yeah, I think it was like 1 in 200 kids in under the age of 2 who were Pacifica in South Auckland got meningococcal disease. Just really horrible numbers. And then we developed the Men's B vaccine, which came in late. It got here. This is probably going away anyway, but we'll claim it. And the Men's B vaccine was there and used for about 3 years and then dispensed with. Here's the up-to-date data on meningococcal disease in New Zealand. Having COVID lockdowns is pretty handy for reducing meningococcal disease, but we had a big bounce back again in 2022. And if you look at the types of meningococcal disease, it's Group B is still our major type in New Zealand. So that's the one that the Bexsero vaccine is helpful for. But there's a little scattering of other disease as well. Again, and in 2024, all of the deaths came with that Group B. There weren't lots of deaths in New Zealand, but every death is a tragedy, isn't it? So the Bexsero, the Men B vaccine that's currently on our immunization schedule we've had for a little over a year and a half or so, is interesting. It's made up partly of the Men's B vaccine, and then they've got three other membrane-associated proteins as part of it. So actually, New Zealand's little contribution to the Bexsero vaccine is there. And just like the Men's B vaccine, it's quite reactive. So we recommend giving paracetamol when children are having their Bexsero vaccine. This is the data from the UK, just to convince you that it's a good idea. The UK introduced Bexsero in this season here, about 2015, and they had a sort of a two-thirds reduction in the cases of meningococcal disease across the board. They already had a Men's C vaccine in the UK, but when they vaccinated, it was pretty effective. And so the under ones, dramatic reduction. The under fours takes a bit of a year later because they need to get a bit older, but dramatic reduction. So we're hoping that in New Zealand we'll get similar help in terms of preventing meningococcal disease. And who can get it? This is the immunization schedule for infants. It's a little bit confusing because it's not licensed until 8 weeks of age, and our immunizations are given at 6 weeks. So they elected to give it at 3 months and 5 months with a booster at 12 months. But there's the option of giving it from 8 weeks and then 4 months. So outside of the time they get their normal vaccinations, if we're really worried or family want to get it in as early as they possibly can. It's really confusing. It's dumb. It would have been nicer if we'd just gone, bar the regulations, let's just give it to 6 weekers. But the powers that be say we can't do that because it's not licensed. So they've had to go for this slightly awkward schedule. So less said about that, the better. If you give it at 6 weeks, it's off label and you have to prescribe it. There is a catch up that I think is through to August this year. So you can get the older kids. You can get the whole whānau if you're getting the littlies. The older ones vaccinated, you can hopefully enlist them as well. But I think that's probably going to run out at some stage. We'll stop funding it. Then the older teenagers, this is both the Men B and the quadrivalent, is funded for adolescents and young people who are going to be living at boarding school, hostel, univehorse or residence, military barracks, or in prison. I don't know why they've come up with that. It's just there's a bump in adolescence of meningococcal disease. This is a way of funding it without funding it for everyone. But I guess the key question I often get asked is by mums and dads who don't have the kids that are in this that want to protect them. Which one should I get, Doc? Should I get the meningococcal B one or the quadrivalent? I'm afraid the only answer to that is you need both. And they're bloody expensive. I'm really sorry, is the only answer. If you want to protect your child against meningococcal disease, they could get either.
Right.
Men B disease is most often in the littlies. So that's why we've just gone with the meningococcal B vaccine for littlies. But for older kids, it can be either. And it's just the dreadful reality that it costs a lot. And if you're not funded, you need both. Because wouldn't it be the worst if you said, No, just get them in B1 and they still got meningococcal disease. So the way I picture it is if you want to protect your child from meningococcal disease, they really have to have both. They are available on the private market, but they're not cheap.
And again, is it reducing severe disease? Is it like varicella? You still have a percentage who could still get it, or is it how effective is it?
It's pretty effective. It's sort of 80, 85% in clinical trials. I was just kind of thinking South Australia, they did it across their adolescent population, and there was a really big reduction in the amount of disease. It's really hard to measure because it's such a rare disease. You saw the numbers that we have. So we're really reliant on big countries like the UK or Australia and how well it's worked over there. But yeah, it is really effective in the short term. So it's really effective for 3 or 4 years. Then it fades
That
away.
was going to be my next question. If they've had, say, men B when they're infant, they're not protected, so they need
They're not
to
protected. So
renew it.
all those folks online who might have had the men's B vaccine when they were youngsters, you are no longer protected. It lasts tops 5 years and you need repeat. So the US actually have a schedule where they vaccinate adolescents at 12 and then 16 or 17, I think. So they have a more comprehensive schedule. Obviously, we're a poor country that has to pick our what we can do. And so it's a single age group around there. What would I do? My lad's going to get it when he's starts kissing girls, I think.
But also highlights, because obviously we live in rural communities where some of our kids go one to boarding school and then two they go to university. So if they have it when they're 13, then they probably still need to get it again when they're 18 and off to uni.
I agree. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why I mentioned the US schedule. So if people are happy to pay, that's what's got to happen, really. Cool. And
Now,
that's all I had, actually. But
that is great. So if there are no questions, that has been fantastic.
actually,
Oh, you've got one.
one
Okay,
question.
great. Good. Go.
It's not going to probably apply yet, but with the pregnant woman who got the chickenpox vaccine, does it make a difference in terms of the exposures you were talking about if they were actually went through the disease versus vaccination, or does it matter either way for pregnancy and things like that?
That's a really good question. I think that's really important. So thank you for bringing that up. We think that varicella vaccine provides long-term protection. It's a bit hard to say for life because it hasn't been around that long, but certainly out to 25 years, and it's probably up to 30 years by now. So I think in general terms, within the level of uncertainty, I would say if they'd had clinical checks, chickenpox, all been vaccinated, then they're okay.
Cool, thank you. And then there's just one from the chat is, what is the dose of acyclovir for chickenpox?
Oh, goodness. I'd have to look it up.
Zealand formulary.
That's exactly my answer to every what is the dose question is the New Zealand formulary. So if it's going to depend. What I was talking about was the giving people an oral acyclovir when they've had an exposure, like the cancer kids. I think we use oral acyclovir 9 or 10 days after their exposure, and then it's a stand. I can't remember the dose, but it's 400 or 500 dose milligrams a dose, so it's 5 times a day acyclovir. So it is a big deal. It's 5 times a day. Whereas if someone's got varicella, primary varicella, and they're immune compromised, then we're using big IV doses. So it depends on the presentation, but yes, formulary has an excellent section on
There's nothing wrong with checking online and checking doses, is there? Because we
it.
cannot remember everything.
Long ago, I told myself that I've forgotten every dose and I have to look it up.
Okay. So on behalf of all of us, Tony, thank you very much for your time this evening. Really appreciated your expertise and your knowledge, and it's been a very interesting presentation. So thank you, and interesting. Thank you very much, everyone, and I'll look forward to seeing you next time. The next webinar is going to be covering urology with Dr. Jim Duthie. So look forward to seeing you all then. Thank you.